Turn your Bibles to the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 10. 1 Corinthians, chapter 10. Last time we were in this passage, I gave you a brief introduction and we read through this passage. Today we're going to dive in and get a little deeper into what is taking place in this text. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I want to ask you a question. How many of you enjoy history? All right. Now, it is not everybody that enjoys history. I enjoyed history growing up in school. I had a great history teacher. I think the teacher that you have really makes a lot of the difference. A great history teacher that really made the events of the past really come alive. Having an opportunity now to educate my own children in the home, my wife and I are experiencing, again, a renewed love for history and reviewing and rehearsing the many different events that took place. What is the value of history? Why is it that history is a part of the educational process? Obviously, somebody came along and said, you know what, let's include history. Why is it such a value? I want to submit to you that the value of history, I believe, stems all the way back to the Scriptures. For in the Scriptures, what you have is many recordings of historical happenings. You see, history isn't history if it's not communicated to people who will hear it and understand it. You see, history is more than just the compilation of dates and names. Anybody know about that? Dates and names. Boy, I remember them. All the dates and the names. But you know what? It's more than that. There's a value behind that. There's a value behind rehearsing these things. And the value is that all of these things, looking at it from a Christian perspective, are things that were orchestrated or overseen by God. And these are experiences that people that had in their lives that we can learn from. They are examples of people that have gone on before us, that have tried and done certain things. Sometimes they have failed, sometimes they were successful. And people wrote these things down so that future generations, such as ourselves, might be able to learn. What do you think they're writing down from our day? What experiences will be written if the Lord should tarry? But think about the Bible. How much of it is history? How much of it is a recording of events that took place, and God has preserved them for His people that we might know His character and His dealings, and we might learn from these examples. I believe our text today verifies this point that I have just made. The value of history, its examples, should have an impact in your life and in my life today. It communicates God's character. It communicates His attributes. They are on display. Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we see Paul introducing an illustration to draw the Corinthians into a better understanding of this importance, of this important truth, that they listen to his words as an apostle of Jesus Christ, and that they seek to live a Christ-centered life. If you've been with us through the study in 1 Corinthians, Paul has been hitting it hard. It's about the cross. It's about Jesus Christ. It is about the gospel, the good news of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It is not about how great your teacher might be. It is about Jesus. And him being an apostle, Paul being an apostle, one who Jesus Christ specifically sent with that mission, go and tell the Gentiles about me. So church, listen to me, is his plea. And he communicates his message, and he communicates how he lives. In chapter 9, he talks about running the race, and he runs it with self-control, and he runs it with perseverance. Because only as if only one will receive the prize, because that's the way it was in those Isthmian games, remember? Running it with that kind of motivation and that kind of passion. And so now he's going to illustrate it in a different format by going to the history books. By going to the history books, and you see him mention here the fathers, these forefathers, the Jewish forefathers, and their experience in the wilderness. First of all, here in verses 1 through 5, we see the state of the Jewish forefathers. Now, follow along with me. Moreover, brethren, verse 1, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, we read this, and then we're quickly sobered. Because we read what he's saying here, that they all had the same things. But even though they all had the same thing, the majority of them, God was not pleased with. What did they all have? Well, first of all, you see they had the same guide. Looking there at 1b, you see that how that all our fathers were under the cloud. You remember back to the wanderings in the wilderness, God gave them the pillar of fire and the cloud that would guide them. That would guide them through these wilderness wanderings so that they might come to the promised land. They all had the very same guide. What else do you see? They had the same deliverance. Look here at the end of verse 1. And all passed through the sea. Notice all. They all had the same guide. They all experienced the same deliverance. Why is that important? It's the crossing of the Red Sea. Come on. Have you ever experienced such a thing? No. But all of these people walked through the Red Sea on dry ground, and Pharaoh's army was back there just waiting to pounce. But God saw them right through, and he delivered them. They all had that same deliverance. Well, what else did they have? Verse 2, they were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all had the same leader. They all had the same leader. In other words, this was Moses. Moses was God's appointed leader for the people of Israel. And here what Paul is saying is that they chose to trust Moses as God's appointed leader. How do we know that? Well, they followed him through the Red Sea. I mean, think about this. Walls of water on either side, and your leader says, walk through there. Go. Would you do that? You wouldn't do it unless you trusted your leader as the leader God had appointed. And we see that. They all had the same guide, the cloud. They all had the same deliverance there at the Red Sea. They all had the same leader, Moses, God's appointed leader. Well, what else did they have? Verse 3. They did all eat the same spiritual meat. We have the same provider. You remember, don't you? The Israelites, some 2 million people, they have come out of Egypt, and now they're in the wilderness, and they're wandering, and they are hungry. Hungry? Do we know what hunger's like? Thirsty? Water? They're just hungry and thirsty, and they begin to complain, and what does God do? Toughen up? No. What does God do? God sends manna. God gives them water out of a rock. God sends quail. You see, all the people experience the same things, and they're in the wilderness. No matter if you were Moses, Joshua, Caleb, the other elders, they all experience these same things, the same provider. Verse 3 talks about the spiritual meat. Verse 4, they did all drink the same spiritual drink. They experienced nourishment and refreshment through whom? And I find this very interesting, what Paul does here in this verse 4, is he speaks of the provider as a spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. He identifies the provider as Christ. I mean, this is baffling to consider, because back there in the Old Testament, in the books of the law, where you have all of this recorded, and all of these different accounts are recorded, and God providing the food, and God providing the water, and He provides it out of a rock. And here Paul says, and draws a little application here for the church, God is a provider. Just like God provided for the people, so Christ provides for you and for me. You remember the story with the woman at the well? And Jesus there, he's chosen to walk through Samaria, a part of the country that Jews did not like to go. And he is outside of Samaria, and he is at a well, and a woman comes to get water. He asks her for water. And she is really curious at him. This is all in John 4. And he begins to tell her, I have water that I can give you where you will never thirst again. Of course, this baffles her. You have nothing to draw with. Jesus calls it living water. Of course, he is speaking of himself, of who he is, and how he himself is a provision of life. He is a giver of life. And so it's a very interesting picture that Paul draws here of the rock. And of course, when you get the picture of a rock in your head, you go back to the Psalms, don't you? And the Psalm speaks of God as our rock and our refuge. I mean, what's that mean to you? It means, boy, I can stand. And I have a sure footing. It's solid. I'm not going to sink. He's a rock. But just like in the Israelites, that rock, there's provision there. Provision for life. And it's Christ. Christ! And I love how Paul just continually reminds the church, the Corinthian church back then, the church in the Grove today, Christ is the provider of life. Keep that close to your soul. So the same provider, and finally there at the end of verse 5, there's the same covenant. You say, where do I get that? Well, notice what happens here. Verse 5, but with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. You see, there was this expectation that God had upon His people. And the expectation was obedience. And God gave that expectation. He communicated that expectation to his people through the law, through the covenant. And the people rebelled against God's law. And the result was the curse of death. The curse of death. Now, this, of course, is very vividly communicated when you read about in Romans these 12 spies. They go out, they look through Canaan, they see the incredible land, the fruit that's there, but they see the giants as well. And they come back, and 10 of them are afraid to go in. 10 of them believe it is not possible for them to overtake such mighty people. But 2 of them communicate a trust in God. 2 of them remember how they crossed through the Red Sea. 2 of them remember how God provided food for them and provided water for them out of the rock. 2 of them understand, remember, that they have a leader who has trusted God and has led them faithfully. 2 of them are remembering that there is a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night that is guiding them faithfully through the wilderness. All of them had those things, but 10 of them chose to not believe. And now, of course, the result of that is that at that point, God said, okay, you're afraid to bring your children in? Okay, you won't bring them in. I will. And it was at that point that God said, for every day the spies were in there looking at the country, 40 days, you will spend 1 year in wandering in the wilderness until every single one of you, 20 years of age and above, have died in the wilderness. And I will bring your children in. You're afraid they're going to die? Okay, you will die. And I will bring them in. And if so, they were right there. But they had to turn around and head back into the wilderness. And for 40 years, they wandered. It's interesting to watch your faces because history teaches us lessons, doesn't it? Your faces are sober. Your faces are, you just can't believe it. You're disappointed. History. It's history. And it has opened our eyes to what? God is a provider. And He gives us many glimpses to build our faith of who He is and His attributes. But we've got to believe Him. We've got to trust Him. And we see that in those 2 men, Joshua and Caleb. I love my parents had a great idea. Joshua and Caleb. And God said, they will go in. And of course, if you know the story, Joshua became the leader of the people, and he led them across the Jordan River and led them in conquering the Canaanites. And God gave them the promised land. And so what we're seeing here is first of all, the state of the Jewish forefathers is that they all had the same things. They all had the same experiences, the same guide, the same leader, the same provider, the same covenant, all of it. But they responded differently, didn't they? And in fact, the majority responded in a way that brought about the curse of death upon their lives. The Old Testament gives us this principle. Obedience brings what? Blessing. Disobedience brings cursing. Yeah. They all had the same. But they chose to believe differently. And the results are tragic. The results are tragic. The state of the Jewish forefathers, secondly,
we see the sin of our unbelieving forefathers. You see this sin here in verse 5, as we've already begun to see here. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Don't miss this expression, many of them. And notice what it says. God was not well pleased. What is God looking for? What is it that God is expecting? Listen, God has created you and me for His pleasure and to bring Him glory. God gave the Israelites, He communicated the law to them, He gave them His expectations, and He longed for them to obey. But most of them did not. They chose to reject God, to not obey. And so the result was, as I have already shared, most of them died there in the wilderness. Death is the sentence. Death. You know, what's fascinating is that when God gave that pronouncement, they're right outside the promised land, and God said, okay, I'm going to bring your children in, and you go wander. You know, what God says there, it impacted their hearts. And they said, okay, we'll believe, we'll do it. And God said, no, you've already made your choice. And they tried, and they got defeated, and off they went. When people rebel against God, when you rebel against God, when I rebel against God, they feel the weight of God's justice. You know, this lesson here of history will teach us about God's justice. What is God's justice? Well, God's justice is that He is completely fair. That if there is something that has happened that is not according to His law or His instructions, there is a punishment for that. And that punishment must be dealt out. God is completely fair. Completely. Maybe those words have come out of your mouth, God, this isn't fair, or you're not fair. Perhaps that has come out in times of great grief or hardship. And God can handle those things. But I trust you truly believe in your heart the opposite. He is completely fair. He is just. He communicated with the people of Israel. They rebelled. And so the punishment was meted out. The curse of death was experienced. So don't be surprised if you are living in sin, or if you choose to live in sin, that you feel the burden, that you feel the weight, that you start getting frustrated with God. Don't be surprised. He's just. And in fact, in Hebrews chapter 12, listen to this, children, and I call you children because we're all children of God. God looks at us as children, and He chastens those whom He loves. Listen to Him. Listen to Him. Jewish forefathers, it's a history lesson. Listen, pay attention. They all had the same thing, but they chose two different paths. The majority of them displeased God. They doubted. They didn't believe. And their sentence was they were overthrown in the wilderness. They trusted themselves more than God. So God brought judgment upon them just like the law said He would. So now in verses 6 through 10, we have some specific examples of what happened to those people as they wandered in the wilderness. These are negative examples, and of course, I don't like using negative examples, and so often I will try to find the positive. But I believe Paul specifically here is choosing these negative examples to make a point for the church. These are five examples of what not to do. How not to live. We would do well to listen. These are five examples that kind of highlight five different aspects of a person's life. Pay attention to these. Verse 6, now these things were our examples. Okay, just so you know, I didn't come up with this on my own. Paul just says it. These are our examples. To the intent that we should, number one, not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now who's the they? Our forefathers who wandered through the wilderness. Lusting after evil things. Well, to lust is to have a passionate desire for something. Evil things are those things that have an innately bad nature or a nature that is contrary to that of the good nature of God. If you want an illustration of this in Numbers chapter 11, in verse 4, it says this, and the mixed multitude that was among them fell lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? Well, what is this lust that they're experiencing? They want food. And they want food from where? Well, look at this. Verse 5. We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely. The cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away, and there is nothing at all besides this, what? Manna before our eyes. What are they doing? They are wanting something that they do not have, but that they do not need. Has God provided for them? Is God meeting their needs? Has God given them abundant promises of a land that they're heading towards? Yes. But all they're thinking about and they're overwhelmed with is, we want our garlic. We want what we had in Egypt. Listen, don't miss this. God delivered them from Egypt. He delivered them from Egypt. God saw Egypt as a place that was evil. And not for them. 10 plagues he placed upon that nation, showing power over their gods. And here they want to go back because they don't have the food they want. We should not be ones who lust after evil, who have passionate desires for things that are not in agreement with the good nature of God. God gave them what they needed. It was sufficient for them. But they wanted more. Look at verse 7, example number 2. Back to 1 Corinthians. I thought that passage looked a little strange.
1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 7. Neither, number 2 here, be ye idolaters, idol worshipers, as were some of them, as it is written. Okay, we're going back to the history books here. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. What is this referring to? The golden calf? Let me refresh you. Moses went up on Mount Sinai, and God said that he would write down the law for Moses. And so Moses was receiving that, and he was up there for a long time. And the people were beginning to get concerned. They were beginning to get a little uncomfortable. And so they had this in their minds. Well, if our leader is up there, and he's talking face to face with God, seemingly, and we're not experiencing anything down here, we're going to do God a little favor, and we'll bring him here. And so what did they do? They made a golden calf, gold, okay, all right, they made it out of gold, and they tried to fashion God. And they fashioned God, and they began to worship. Notice how they're worshiping. Eating, drinking, and playing. There's a connotation here that you don't necessarily see in the text, but there's sexual things going on here. Isn't it interesting how often you see idolatry and sexual immorality linked? We could talk more about why that link is there, but notice that. Idolatry is they're worshiping a god that they had fashioned. And even though maybe they used God's name, it was not worshiping God in the way he had prescribed. Because what did he say? He said it clearly. Do not make unto thee any graven image. God will not and cannot be put into some image or object, be fashioned by man. There is only one image that has ever done God perfectly. And who is that? Jesus Christ. Because he was God. He was God. He accepted worship. God came, was not fashioned by man. He's not created by God because he was God himself. But he came. Why do we talk so much about Jesus? Why do we worship Jesus? He's God. And he came in human flesh, so that people could know him and touch him and hear God's voice. And they did. But God came so that the souls of men might be saved and released from the bondage of sin. He was the fulfillment of the law, where law convicted us of our sin. It did not give us a permanent resolution for it until Jesus Christ came, who was the perfect Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. Do not be an idol worshiper. Worship God in the way he has prescribed. And it is not an image. It is not something you have fashioned. It is not a form that you have made. He desires to be worshiped in spirit and in truth. That's what he told the woman at the well. He's a spiritual being. He is truth. And he is to be worshipped as such. Thirdly, In verse 8, neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. We should not be committing fornication. Now, I want to stop here and just remind you of something. Paul is writing all of this to the Corinthian church. And remember the culture that in which they live? There was all kinds of evil surrounding them. There were idols and temples, and they would have practiced this idolatrous worship all their lives. Fornication was part of it. The temple up at the top of the hill outside of the city had 1,000 temple prostitutes. We should not be committing fornication. Sexual immorality should not be a part of our lives. Let's learn from history. In Numbers chapter 25, it tells us about this experience, this event. Verse 1 of Numbers 25, Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom, fornication with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat and bow down to their gods. And Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against them. If you read on, you see that God brought an incredible plague upon those people. And many thousands died. Why? Because they were committing sexual sin, immorality. It's a serious thing, folks. Young people, listen to me. I know that our world and our culture desires you to be sexually immoral. And if you haven't got that, you need to know that. That is not God's way. It is not good. It is not right. It will not help your future marriage or relationships. That's all lies. 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 God's way is the best way, the right way. Sex is reserved for in the relationship of marriage, one man and one woman. We should not be committing fornication. Fourthly, we should not test Christ. In verse 9, 1 Corinthians 10:9, neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. If you look at this passage in Numbers 21, we're not going to go there, but this was the passage where the people began to question God's intentions. That basically what they were saying is, God, you don't know what you're doing. Have your children ever told you that? You don't know what you're doing. How did you take that? Just let it roll off? It's kind of hard to let that roll off, isn't it? They are questioning God's intentions. I mean, we could sit back and say, how dare you? Paul here is writing from the historical standpoint to the Church of Corinth and for us today. You'd question God's intentions? Not only that, they are calling God's provisions worthless. Look at the text, Numbers 21. We're not going to go there now, but on your own, look at what they say about what God has provided for them. They say it's worthless. We should not test Christ. We should not challenge Him and His authority, His provisions, His guidance, His leadership. Don't test Christ. Fifthly, we should not grumble and complain. I remember growing up, I heard this often. Don't grumble or complain. King James says, murmurings and disputings, believe that's in Philippians. When we think of the people of Israel as they're going through the wilderness, I dare say one of the first things that comes to your mind is the fact that they complained. Right? They were a complaining people. They grumbled. And they grumbled about all kinds of things. But the main things they grumbled about was what? Food and water. We want food and we want our kind of food and we want the food of Egypt and we need water and we need it now. And here Paul brings up this example from history in verse 10. Neither murmur you as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. The destroyer, if you look in Numbers chapter 14, the destroyer is a reference to a plague that came through the people and just began killing them. God took these things very seriously. And so now Paul is bringing this to our attention. Wake up, church, and notice the very holiness and righteousness of God. Notice how he dealt with his people. These people that had all the same things. They had all the same platform upon which they could observe God and trust in him. And they chose to do things differently. And thousands upon thousands of these people died. An entire generation perished in the wilderness. And so you, church, pay attention, for our God is a just God. Our God demands worship and worship in his ways. I'm going to wrap it up. Verse 11. Now all these things happened unto them for examples. He repeats it again. So listen, these are examples we are to learn from. And they are written for our admonition. Upon whom the ends of the world are come. That's you and me. They're written down for our admonition. So pay attention to the examples of history. And the specific examples that Paul gives here are ones that are highlighted for a reason, because God knows that these are areas that are where we experience weakness as human beings. So, verse 12, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Take heed, pay attention, be warned. You see, each one of these people, the 10 spies that came back, they took a stand. They took a stand and they said, that place is full of giants that we could never conquer. What were they really saying? Our God is too small to lead us in there. Other people took a stance and they said, listen, God, yes, you gave us this manna, but it's not good enough for us. God, we're thirsty and we want water now. God, your intentions of leading us across the wilderness, we question that. What's your stance today? What is it that you're taking a stand on? Are you taking a stand in rebellion against God? Oh, maybe it's not this big deal, but maybe there's this area in your life where you're saying, no. No, God. You're too small to handle that one. Or maybe you're saying, no, God. I'll give you everything but this. Wherefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall.
This is a sobering warning for us. Should we take a stand? Absolutely. But you need to know what you're standing for and what you're standing upon, who you're standing upon. Let me ask you some questions. Are you desiring that which is pleasing to God? Are you worshiping God alone and in the way He has prescribed? Or have you fashioned Him to meet your own liking? Are you morally pure in the sight of God? I believe the end of that question is important. Because you might appear like you're morally pure to all of us. But in the sight of God, who sees all, knows all, are you morally pure? Are you confident in God's leading and provisions? Do you trust Him? His provisions for you, are you content with what He has given you? Are you confident in the way He is leading and directing your life? You have the same God, as the Apostle Paul did. The same guide desires to guide you to a life of holiness and giving Him glory. You have the same provider, who is Jesus Christ, who has provided not only your salvation through His shed blood upon the cross, but a future and a hope. You have the Spirit of God living within you, who is described as a guide unto all truth. Where are you taking your stand today? Take your stand upon Christ. Live for His glory and to please Him and Him alone. God, thank You for Your word. Thank You for these examples from history. And although, God, I've barely touched the surface of these things, and I feel as if so much more could have been said, and maybe even better said, but Lord, I'm so glad this is Your church, and this is Your word, and this is what You wanted communicated today. So take it, use it. You know what each of us needed today. You know the hearts of each one of us. Thank You for overseeing all of these things. Ask the musicians to come forward. We're going to sing in closing a hymn, I Surrender All. This is one of those hymns that, as you sing it, it's 596. As you sing it, it's one of those hymns that, if you're singing, consider what you're singing. All to Jesus I surrender. All to Him I freely give. I will ever love and trust Him in His presence daily live. Oh, church, sing with the conviction of what you truly believe in your heart. And if you're not there yet, I trust and I pray that God will bring you to a point of surrender and of trust.